Hello, podcastaways. I hope you're well. It's Irregular Paul here. That's my new nickname. I'm working on it. Welcome to another Irregular Podcast. It has been the Heptagon Club. Now it's a Paul Carenza podcast, currently offering the last of our Comedians with Books panel chats. So basically, if you've not caught up, I've retired the old podcast, but I pay to keep it online whether I upload stuff or not. So I see nothing wrong with flouting podcast rules and using this as a sort of channel for my stuff, which, you know, changes occasionally. So right now, it's changing again, I hate to say. Before the final Comedians with Books, this time with friend of the show, Stephen Colgan, him of the Heptagon Club days, former QI Elf and so on, and new friend of the show, James Dowdeswell, a fine comedian. They're on soon talking about pubs and whodunits and their books. But first, news of a new thing, which you can get for free, but it will mean taking some action to enjoy it. So listen up. I've got a new podcast launching this very weekend. So by the time you listen to this, it's probably out there. It's a notch above a podcast. Really, it's more like a radio series. There's a budget, there's a studio, there's a fantastic producer, there's a fab famous co-host, and basically, it's on Audible. Okay, that's what's going on there. So here's what happened. We pitched an idea to them, and they bit. Audible fancied what we were pitching, something Christmassy, and it's via the producers of Pause for Thought that I do the Radio 2 breakfast show with, TBI Media, lovely people, and Audible have been lovely as well. So if you're not familiar with Audible original podcasts, basically you have to be on Audible to get it, but you can get a free trial. So more info of that shortly. First of all, I should say, I'm out about enjoying some Christmas shopping, so you might hear some cars going by, some shoppers heckling me, that sort of thing. Tis the season. You will know, regular listeners, how much I love Christmas. So much so that that's where I am right now amid Black Friday sales, pretty much. But yeah, so I wrote this book, Hark, the Biography of Christmas, a couple of years ago now. And this year I've put book club notes online. I mentioned that last time. paulcarenza.com/harknotes.pdf. I'll put that in the show notes if you fancy. I'm also recording the audiobook of Hark, the Biography of Christmas, this very week. So that will be hopefully out this side of Christmas. But meanwhile, yeah, this new podcast with Audible, right? So it's all about Christmas and a bit of Christmas past and a bit of Christmas present and just fun as well. It's called Christmas, What the Fa-la-la, or Fa-la-la-la. I can never quite work out how many la's are in there. It wasn't my first choice of title, if I'm honest, but Audible liked it. So we're gone with it. Christmas, What the Fa-la-la-la-la. I will tell you more about it after the first chunk of Comedians with Books on this here podcast episode. Here are the headlines, okay? A, I'm very excited about it. B, yes, Audible do audiobooks, but they also do podcasts, okay? They're called Audible Original Podcasts. And basically, if you subscribe to Audible, you get all of their podcasts for free. You've got to download them to get them. I'll explain a bit more the specifics of how to do that later in the podcast. Let's not get distracted by such things. I put more info, and there's a free trial as well. If you go to paulcarenza.com/audible.php, now let's get that exactly right, Paul Carenza, paulcarenza.com/audible.php. You need the PHP, okay? Again, that link will be in the show notes, right? You get a free trial there, and if I'm honest, right, if you go via that link, I get a bit of a kickback, okay? I get a fiver, right? Even if you do a free trial and then cancel it, you can never pay anything. Audible give me a little bit of money by shoving someone their way. And they are really good, right? Okay, they're not paying me to say this because it might be that no one clicks on that thing and I get 0 pence. But basically, I've done a podcast for them and I'd like people to listen to it because we had such fun doing it, right? It's me and it's Grace Dent. The fantastic broadcaster, journalist. You might have seen her on Have I Got News For You, read her acerbic articles in The Guardian, or heard her brilliant Radio 4 show, The Untold. She's a journalist and a food critic. And she's now co-host with me on Christmas, What the Fa-la-la-la-la. So the podcast over there is six episodes, really, of Grace and myself deep diving into Christmas. We've got episodes on the Nativity and Panto, Santa, food, trees, decorations, cards, Christmas films. And each episode has me doing two sort of solo, fun, festive, historical rants. We've got a game or two, and we've got a fantastic guest each episode as well. I will tell you who those fantastic guests are after we hear from the fantastic guests on this podcast episode. Let's not get distracted from them. This is Comedians with Books, episode number 3 of that. It's a live show that we have been doing with Guildford Fringe Festival. It's probably time that we've called it a day there because, you know, it was a nice experiment for a little while. The idea was comedians who've written books come along, talk about their books, talk about their writing, what inspires them, their publishing route, that sort of thing. So this time it's Stephen Colgan and James Dowdeswell. I'll pop again about halfway through and tell you a bit more about the Audible stuff and also the Miranda Hart's Christmas special, the big reunion show we filmed last week at the Palladium, plus also some book stuff, a message for the beta readers that we talked about last time, and some gig info as well. Loads of things to just generally talk about and express about, and we will get to that after this excerpt from the live show of Comedians with Books.
And welcome back to Comedians with Books. Give a round of applause for James Dowdeswell and Stephen Colgan. Hooray! James, what was your route to publication? Did you approach a publisher? Did they approach you, or did you just have their work?
Well, in 2015, I did a show in Edinburgh called James Dowdeswell's Perfect Pub, and I thought what I basically did was in the show I would ask the audience, what's your perfect pub? What would you want in your perfect pub? And so, unwittingly, over 26 nights, I did a survey, and found out what everybody wanted in their perfect pub. A friend of mine, Philippa, said, why don't you write a book? I approached a publisher and she said, oh, don't know about that. A publisher agent. And she said, oh, I don't know. I grew up in a pub. I don't think there's anything interesting about that. Fortunately, I'm quite stubborn. I thought, no, I think there is something interesting about that. And I did a gig at Ram Brewery in Wandsworth. And I met a bloke from Canberra. And he said, well, Canberra, I've got a publishing arm. So I phoned up Canberra Books and said, oh, hello, I'd like to publish a book, please. And they said, oh, we'll put you straight through to Simon. Simon's the boss, spoke to Simon, he goes, oh, excellent, send me 2 chapters. I sent him 2 chapters. On the following Tuesday, he went, yep, I've read those chapters, I'm interested in publishing that. Do you want to meet? We'll have a meeting, because I'm from Canberra, I believe all meetings should take place in a pub.
Of course.
So I met in St Albans, and he said the first draft was too much stand-up, but he said, if you smooth it out with facts, I think we've got a book there. Now, I've since tried to phone Canberra Books for any reason whatsoever. They've never even answered the phone, let alone got through to the boss, so I got completely lucky on that particular day.
So right idea, right place, right time.
Exactly.
The stars aligned.
Tuesday afternoon, 3:17.
There you go. Good to know. I've cited you actually, James Dowdeswell, a few times as when people talk about the state of the comedy circuit and how it's all sort of kind of a bit shrink, you know, fewer clubs than used to be,
yep.
More comedians than there used to be, everyone's diversifying a bit. And so I've ended up doing more events for churches because I do a few of those things, and suddenly there's a few people who do those, and then you get more bookings. And I've started you because you do like vineyards, wine drinking.
Yeah, clubs, I tend to do. Well, Paul and I have something in common, which is we're the most alternative comics out there. I'm not religious, but Paul, and about 3 others don't swear. We're completely clean.
Off.
But no, I went to Australia, and in Australia you can talk about wine, and the whole idea of a pom knowing about wine in Australia is hilarious. So I'm like the Henning of Australia. So I can sell really well in Australia.
And there was this, I remember you doing your wine show in Edinburgh a few years ago, about 10 years ago probably now. And it's one of these examples of you have one idea for one show that suddenly, you know, a decade later,
yes,
it's opened up this whole industry as well.
Yeah, you suddenly realise, oh, it's fun to talk about, you know, like you do, to talk about what you know and what you are enjoying, and hopefully people find it funny too.
And if Stephen, I know that before your books you've been mentioning tonight, you've done several books which have built on that, the fact side of things, haven't they? Were those your first attempts?
Yeah, I mean, the first book was quite traditionally published in the fact that just before I started working for QI, and in fact just before I finished working as a police officer, I'd written a book called Joined Up Thinking. It wasn't called that originally, that's the title they had to change it to because we had a bit of a spat with Rick Wakeman. Long story, I won't go into it. Well, the short of it was...
Yeah, I'd like to start with that.
It was originally called The 6 Degrees of Rick Wakeman. because it was all about connections. And what I found is Rick Wakeman is kind of like Britain's Kevin Bacon. He is connected to everyone. I mean, if you don't know, you know, when you listen to David Bowie, Life on Mars, that's Rick Wakeman on the piano. When you listen to Cat Stevens, Morning is Broken, that's Rick Wakeman on the piano. When you listen to The Strawbs, Part of the Union, that's Rick Wakeman on the piano. He was a jobbing, working keyboard player, and he was much better than most of the other jobbing, working keyboard players. So he's on every album.
Not only that, he used to host Live at Jongleurs.
He did, and it's the other thing. He was one of the original founders of Jongleurs as well. Yeah. He does lots of charity stuff. He plays golf. He is connected to everyone, and wherever I went in this book, it kept coming back to Rick Wakeman. So I got in contact with him and saying, no, I want to call this book The 6 Degrees of Rick Wakeman, which I thought was a nice pun on the fact his first album was called The 6 Degrees of Henry VIII, and he'd been married a few times. And I thought, that's a nice pun. And he loved it. He absolutely loved it. He wrote a foreword for it. And then, literally, as the final draft of the book went into Pam McMillan, I had an order slapped on me by his management saying, no, you can't have Rick Wakeman's name on the cover. Rick's decided to bring out his memoirs, and Rick being Rick, he doesn't want Rick Wakeman on the cover. He's called it Grumpy Old Rockstar, and we're afraid people will buy your book thinking it's his.
So it's the publisher's, not Rick.
It wasn't Rick himself. Rick was brilliant about it. It ended up being called Joined Up Thinking, which I hated as a title, but we had to come up with something at the 11th hour. So when I did the sequel, I called that 6 Degrees of Rick Wakeman, and got an order slapped on me not to do that, because Rick's second volume of memoirs is coming out at the same time. So I've still got this intro by Rick Wakeman. I've still got a lovely letter from him saying he wants to do this, and I've never actually got around to using that title.
One day, and then of course he'll book three.
When he's dead or something, or when his manager's dead.
Well, he should have a book, the 6 forewords of Rick Wakeman.
like
a lot.
Yeah.
It goes to show that maybe that's indicative of the fact that in that story, then publishers are getting in the way of actual creative people like Rick Wakeman and yourself wanting to just do a thing.
But don't you find the background stuff, like the publishers and the agents, get in the way anyway? I mean, the number of times we would phone up, because I used to work on a show called The Museum of Curiosity as well, if you've ever heard it on Radio 4.
Yeah,
very good. QI's sort of sister show. And we used to think, at the beginning of the year, we'd sit down and make a wish list of who we wanted on the show, and then we'd phone up their agents to see if we could get them on. Now, you'll know this, Paul, because you work in radio. The wages aren't large, are they?
They're not great.
No, but I mean, a lot of people who are mega rich say, yeah, I'd love to do that because it'll be great fun. So consequently, we had Terry Pratchett, we had Neil Gaiman, we had Jimmy Wales, who created Wikipedia, we had Buzz Aldrin, we had some amazing guests. Occasionally, we found out Helen Mirren's agent, and honestly, I could hear the laughter across the room when we said how much we were going to pay her. But there were a lot of people we phoned up and said, will you be on the show? And their agent said, no, don't be so ridiculous. See, I'm doing that on the phone like it's a real phone. It wasn't like this. I mean, that's the thing about mobile phones. It's not, you could slam the old phones down, couldn't you? It's not something like, yeah, and you too. It's not the same, is it? But
it's the same with the Kindle. You can't slam a Kindle shut with a fly in.
No, you can't. But we had a lot of people who we asked to come on the show, and their agent said no. And then we met them in other circumstances later on. They go, God, I love that show. I would love to have done it. So it's sometimes the background people do get in the way, the agents and the publishers.
Mm. Yeah, I certainly feel a bit harsh, because in your case, it wasn't the publisher getting in the way, it was Rick Wakeman's management. But I suppose what I was trying to lean towards was that you were traditionally published, and now you're with Unbound, aren't you? So what? How's the Unbound experience been?
The Unbound experience is all right. Do we all know what Unbound is?
No.
Yeah. Basically, 2008 particularly, around that time, there was a big revolution in publishing, as I said earlier. There was the threat from e-books, there was lots of book chains closing down, and a lot of publishers pulled up their skirts and said, we're only going to take on stuff that are dead certs. Unbound grew out of that. Unbound is a bunch of people who previously had quite lucrative book contracts and were just suddenly told, we don't want your next book because you're not famous enough. And otherwise, there were people who'd sold quite well. And they decided to start their own publishing company. And what they decided to resurrect was a model that was used in the past. I mean, Dickens, all of Charles Dickens' books were published by public subscription. They were put out in instalments and people paid for the next instalment. Dr. Johnson's dictionary was published by basically crowdfunding, by him going around to people saying, give me the money to do this dictionary. So they decided to combine crowdfunding, which had started coming on as a bit of a thing because of Kickstarter and things like this, to combine traditional publishing with crowdfunding. And the idea is that you pitch a book as normal to Unbound, and they'll either say yay or nay. You know, and about 1 in 5 books that they get pitched, they say, yeah, we like that book, we'll go with that. They then create a platform for that book on their website, set a total, and then the author goes off and crowdfunds the money to cover the book's publication costs. Then once that's done, it switches over to traditional publishing again. So you get your two rounds of editing, you get proofreaders, you get cover design and all that sort of thing, and then the book ends up in the shops, or it ends up as an e-book.
And do they provide those, the proofreaders, the editorial side?
Yeah, everything. It's all incorporated in that cost that you've crowdfunded. Mm-hmm. And the average sort of paperback book, you have to raise about, well, anything between $6,000 and $12,000, depending on how big it is and how much it is. But I've done it, well, I'm just on my sixth campaign at the moment.
Brilliant.
And it's the other nice thing about it is because this is started by authors, they offer you a fair share of the profits as well. I mean, with Pam McMillan, my first book went out, I got maybe about 6-7% profits. Right. With Unbound, everything above the total you've got to reach, the crowdfunding total, everything above that is split 50-50.
That's brilliant.
So okay. The author gets 50 and Unbound gets 50.
I get 15%.
Yeah. Well, I get 50% of all my books.
What do you get on yours?
It varies book to book, but it's about 10% on those traditional published ones.
I'm not sure if this is right. So we're in a revolutionary seller here, so
yeah.
No one
else. Yeah.
But I was told by my publisher that on Amazon, they buy them in Amazon, that Amazon takes 75%.
They do, yeah.
Did you guys know that?
It's massive.
That's extortion. They get a lot.
75%.
If you self-publish, of course, with Amazon Kindle things, then the author gets to keep 70% of the taking. So there's a very much big movement to people going, actually, do we even need the publishers, the bookshops? Yeah.
It's good for writers. It's a good atmosphere for writers at the moment, because it's never been easier to get published. Amazon, I did some stats recently, and Amazon publishes their new ebook to their ebook collection, one new ebook every 1.8 seconds.
Wow.
The groundswell of ebooks is absolutely massive, so it's really hard to get noticed in amongst them. But some people do.
Some people do write smaller ebooks, don't they?
Yeah, and sort of around 20,000 words is very popular at the moment. 20,000 to 30,000 words is very popular. Novella.
It does seem that those who are doing that seem to churn them out fairly swiftly.
Oh, they do.
Some people who write six novels a year or something, because they're self-publishing and every one feeds the next one, and then you have a read through. I suppose they think of it as, you know, you buy one, but then you want to get the next one and the next one, and so on.
Some of them are phenomenally bad, and some are just hilariously phenomenal. I mean, the whole podcast, My Dad Wrote a Porno, has grown out of... Anyone listen to that? Oh my God, it's amazing.
I'm aware of it.
Yeah, you've got to listen to it. It's a guy who discovered that his retired salesman dad had seen 50 Shades of Grey and thought, well, I could bloody do that, and started writing his own porn and putting it up on Amazon, and it's so bad. I mean, for a start, he doesn't understand how he even got born, because he completely doesn't understand female anatomy. And every week on this podcast, there's three people. It's the lad who's reading his dad's novel, so he's cringing with embarrassment reading this anyway, because his dad's written this, and his two best mates. And they read a chapter from it every episode while drinking wine. It's the best podcast it really is.
And now they do big tours. Is the pornographic book that the dad is that out there? Can people actually? I don't know if there's ever.
Yeah, you can actually go and buy it. It's called Belinda Blinked. Well, it's the Belinda Blinked series.
I hope he's still making more.
He writes under the name of Rocky Flintstone, and I'm delighted. I'm delighted that he gave me cover quote for the last book while it's up there.
Speaking of podcasts, then, don't forget the takeaway from this episode is I would love to see you on the other side over on the Audible Original podcast. So honoured that they put their trust in me to make a show for them. But we do need you there, okay? I'm well aware that by putting things behind a kind of paywall, even though there's a free trial and all that sort of stuff, but by doing that, it does limit your audience, of course. This is actually, if I'm honest, it's an idea of a show we pitched to Radio 4 as well. But Audible, they went for it, and they wanted what we were selling, really. And what we were selling was something that we love, which is Christmas, and just talking about it and deep diving into those customs and traditions and that sort of thing. So if you get to paulcarenza.com/audible.php, links in the show notes, you need that PHP, very important, you'll find all the info about it. Here's a step-by-step guide, right, if you need it, of how to basically get this Audible podcast, right? Here's what you do. Step one, you go to that link, paulcarenza.com/audible.php. You read a bit more about the Christmas podcast, by all means, or don't read anything, not a problem. Click on the link or the Audible pick, the little banner thing. You'll be taken straight to Audible via Amazon, who own Audible, and you sign up. There's a free trial there. If you've not had a free trial in the last 12 months, you can have another one if you've had one previously. It does need card details, of course, but trust me, look, I've cancelled before. I signed up, did the free trial, cancelled it. It's legit, okay? And you get a free audiobook, any audiobook you want, for everything Harry Potter, if you want that. Lonesome Dove is one I've got on my phone, the great Western epic War and Peace. Get your money's worth, basically. Don't get a podcast, an audiobook thingy that's just a couple of hours long. No, right? Even our podcast series is 3 hours long. You want to get an audiobook that's 10 to 20 hours long. That's what you want. Get the full Bible. It's all up there. David Suchet's recorded it, right? Point four, right. Go to the top bar of Audible once you are there via that link on my webpage, and you will find original podcasts, okay? If you click on that, then from this weekend, the start of December, you will find Christmas What the Fa-la-la-la-la. Again, not my choice. You might need to search for it, or it might even be there with a nice big logo if we're kind of nearing Christmas. But seek it out anyway. That's the podcast. Look for Christmas What the Fa la 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 la. Download any other podcast as well, by all means, for free. You can get Stephen Fry's. Dermot O'Leary's got a great interview podcast there. There's a lovely podcast about dinosaurs. Loads of true crime, if that's your thing. David Suchet's Questions of Faith is fantastic as well. Then you've got that on your computer, right? But really, it's best enjoyed as an app on your phone. So that's step six, get the app. And then step seven, just enjoy audiobooks, really. Like I said, I'm recording The Hark, the biography of Christmas, as an audiobook, and that might be on there by Christmas as well, but that wouldn't be for a few weeks yet. But for now, join me and Grace Dent and our six brilliant guests. We've got Lucy Porter, Milton Jones, Atif Nawaz, Angelica Bell, you might know from The One Show, and she's a brilliant cook as well, so she's on our food episode. We've got Sean Keaveney from Six Music. He's brilliant on just his home domestic Christmases and the chaos that ensues. And comedian Andy Zaltzman, him of The Bugle. They all join us to get thoroughly festive. Oh man, they were fun. So do it, please. Thank you. Needn't cost you a penny. I will stop talking about that. Before we get back to Comedians with Books, big thank you to those of you who signed up to be beta readers on the last episode. So if you did, you will notice I have failed to send you anything. I did say I would send some little stories, and I haven't. I will, but probably next year now. Okay, life got busy. What can I say? Doing what? Life got busy doing what, I hear you ask. Well, Miranda Hart's Christmas special, the reunion show, recorded that last week. That was such fun, of course. That's on between Christmas and New Year, I believe. If you want to know which bits I wrote, well, let's say the fun bits, okay? The bits you like, that I did those. I got to rewrite some words to a famous pop song, I will say that much. So when that comes on, do enjoy that. I've been doing some great pause for thoughts as well. I say great, I mean, you know, been great fun to do, alongside big, big guests like Michael Palin, David Walliams, Robbie Williams, Idina Menzel. That's just been bonkers to be doing those Pauls for Thoughts with them there. I've had a third kids book out, Joe's Bros and The Bus That Goes. That is out now. And I'm back on the road until Christmas doing Comedians and Carols all over the shop. Do come and see me wherever that is. Comediansandcarols.com. Again, I will, I'll put some info on the show notes, and I will tell you where we are exactly by the end of the episode. For now, though, back to Comedians with Books.
The one thing I would say is, in my experience, is whatever you do, get a good editor.
Oh, God, yeah.
And spend the money on the editor. For my book, I got the editor who edits the Good Beer Guide for Canberra, so I knew facts. If I got two facts wrong in the book, I'd be absolutely rinsed. I went to a book signing of somebody else who was doing a homebrew book, and somebody I know said, "Oh, well, are you writing a book about pubs? Oh, you're going to get trashed online." So I knew that two facts wrong and I'm in trouble. Especially, I don't know about you, when you write, my partner's not very well, and so I do her job. She runs a doggy daycare, so I do that from 9 to 5. So I was getting up at 6:30 in the morning to write. And what was quite strange was sort of 6:30 in the morning, and you're pyjamas and dressing gown writing about tequila. It was a bit sort of weird. In the evening, it'd be all right because I'd sort of taste something and write about it, but it was strange.
Oh, so you're not drinking it at 6:30 in the morning?
No, I'm not drinking tequila, but it was... I
how
just remember
hot dogs?
No.
That was a lovely evening for
me. Very strange writing about certain subjects. A certain time.
Well, they do say, you know, that if you get a book you particularly are, you know, passionate about, you would need to get out there, that you set the alarm, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning if need be to get it done.
Yeah. Well, when are your fertile times to write?
I've spent the day in Guildford in coffee shop hopping, I'm pretty well caffeinated by now.
Coffee shops are great, and there is some science behind that in the fact that if you try and work in silence, your brain will look for things to distract you. That's what, oh, screw. You'll find anything. And if it's too noisy, it's the same. But if you've got a general hubbub of noise in the background at a certain level, it actually helps. And it's funny, I mean, you mentioned Stephen Fry. He put me onto something because I was saying, how the hell do you write your books? And he said, well, I can't sit in a coffee shop because everyone's coming up saying, you're Stephen Fry and I love you. But he mentioned this to some software geeks in America. Right. And they created a website called Coffeetivity. And it's absolutely true. There's a website called Coffeetivity. It's coffeetivity.com. If you log onto it, it plays the sound of a coffee shop.
Wow.
And you can pick different coffee shops around the world. You have one in Paris, one in New York, and that. You just put that on your computer speakers that's in the amazing. Background. You can sit at home and you feel like you're in a coffee shop.
That's incredible.
It's amazing. It really works.
I thought you were going to say, told the technicians they made some prosthetics, and now he sits in coffee shops.
That's incredible. That'd be quite cool, wouldn't it?
When I say I got up at 6:30, that was the when I decided to really seriously write the book. When the first half of the book I actually wrote, surrounded by about 8 dogs in the living room, and so I couldn't actually write on the laptop. And also, I don't know if you boys and girls are the same, that when you try and write something on the laptop, you look at that empty screen, and it's quite intimidating.
Yeah.
And I couldn't write on the laptop because the dogs try and lick everything. And so I literally, the first draft of the book, I texted it, and then when I got into... when I got the publishing deal, I got into a problem where I was getting a bit of a writer's block, so I went back to texting again. So I texted the whole first draft is texted.
Well, in fact, I'm trying to write a novel at the minute, but because it's something that no one is asking for, and there's no money, and there's no interest, I was finding it very difficult to motivate myself.
Yeah.
I've got the idea, just getting it on paper. So I thought, given that when I had my writing time, I was writing for other people, you know, because I do sitcom writing and things like that, I thought, I'm not getting the time to write my thing. So I started writing it on an app on my phone. There's a novel writing app.
Right.
And I started doing that, thinking, well, when I've got some time with my phone, rather than check Twitter or Facebook or play a game of Scrabble, I'll do a bit of another little mini chapter of the novel.
Were you writing it, or were you doing it via Siri?
I was writing it via Thumbs.
Oh, Thumbs.
And I got probably a couple of chapters in.
Look at these West Country novelists. We write with our thumbs, you know.
All 3 of them.
give me 6.
I would say I got about 2 chapters in, and I thought, that's taken me 8 months, when actually if I hadn't spent some time on the laptop, I could have got a lot more done.
Yes.
So I've now taken it from the app to the computer so I can use all 10 fingers.
But do you find it frees you up? I mean, I found it frees me up to text it. I could literally just, it's like throwing paint at a wall. But as soon as I sit there with a laptop, I don't know, the same with you boys, I feel a little bit of a freeze. Oh, this has got to be good. Whereas I can check something, and it's free. It's free.
Yeah, for me on the laptop now. I've moved to that. I've actually found I've got a lot more done since I started in Microsoft Word, getting very analytical and geeky now. But then I've actually now switched to
what's your font?
Comic Sans. No, never. Windings. I'm doing a lot in Excel instead, just to get the outline down and scene by scene, which characters are in each scene, all that sort of stuff. And by doing it as a spreadsheet, I can sort of keep tabs on that A plot line and the B plot and the C plot.
Putting words in the numbers.
I mean, there is software that can help you do that. There's software like Scrivener.
Scrivener.
Yeah, which is a bit like Word, but you've also got all that sort of spreadsheet stuff going on the side. I just write in Word. And I keep notebooks. Notebooks are really important. I just write down everything I see, everything I think's funny. I mean, just this week, some great stories I was reading about. A search for a missing tourist in Iceland was called off after 3 hours when they realised the woman they were searching for was in the search party. Or another great story I read about a bloke who got, he was digging a hole, he found some metal on his metal detector, and he got down 6 feet before he realised it was his steel toe caps. Real life is funnier than anything, and you think, oh God, that's brilliant. Or I see a brilliant name, I think I'm having that name. I'm lucky in the fact that my house, I've managed to get rid of all the kids. which is great. Still got the dogs, but I've still got the kids. No more kids.
There's a good doggy. There's a doggy daycare you can use.
Yeah. I know, yeah.
He's a bit
three.
Drunk.
I've got three, or two and a half. You can have them.
Put baby reins on, I'm happy to take them around.
Fantastic. But I've actually got a room where I can write when I'm at home. And I go, and I've tried to be quite disciplined. I go in there at sort of like 8 in the morning, and I'll write through till about 11. Mm. Then I'll have, you know, a cup of tea and a biscuit, and then I'll write through till about 1. Take the dogs out for a walk for an hour. That's always good for freshening your brain up. And then sort of afternoon tiffin at about 3, you know, tea and a biscuit, and then I come out there and lock the door at 6.
Yeah. And but there is that thing of people who spend a lot of money going to a friend of my partner's, he spends a fortune going to these writer's retreats. Oh, yeah, and for me, I just had to, because I sat on this sofa surrounded by dogs, when I got up at 6:30 in the morning, all I needed to do was sit in the same spot in the sofa and have a sip of coffee, and then I was in. Yeah. It was more to do with getting in a mindset.
It is.
Than external.
I live out in Buckinghamshire. I live very close to Great Missenden. It's about 2 miles up the road from me.
Roald Dahl,
which is where Roald Dahl lives. And if you look at his shed, you go and visit his shed, that's exactly what he did. He said, I'm going to work now. He walked down to the shed in the garden. He had a very particular way of doing things with this weird rolling piece of wood, and then a board on top of that, and he wrote. But he had to do that to write. He couldn't sit on a typewriter. Other people, Tom Sharp, one of my great heroes, great comic writer, he had 19 typewriters around his house. So as he was walking around, you know, sort of doing the compost, doing the washes, oh, I've got an idea. And he'd sort of collate it all at the end of the day. People have to find their method.
The previous comedians with books, we had James Carey, who's a sitcom writer.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
And he's done a couple of books. Mm. And I know, I'm sure you won't mind me saying, when he moved house and they got a new build thing, they sort of could design the house to a degree. And so he got an office in the house, as you know, ideally maybe would. But rather than have a door to that office from within the house, they deliberately put the door on the outside of the house, so that when he goes to work, he goes out the sort of the French windows, turns left again, and then he's in his office.
You're going to work.
There's
something about going to work. Stephen King does the same. He's got this magnificent clifftop house in Maine, but he actually walks down a set of steps out of his house to a smaller clifftop house in Maine where he actually works. And the rest of the family don't go there.
Yeah. If anybody's thinking of writing or doing anything, the book Stephen King on writing is a brilliant read.
I don't particularly like Stephen King as a writer.
That book is his best book.
It's really good.
Stephen King's example is someone that you could tell he would write anyway, even if you weren't making a fortune every book. And he devours books he reads them all the time. He is a complete aficionado.
Yeah, he also said a thing that resonated with me. He said that the right word is the right word for that sentence. It doesn't need to be a flashy word, it can be a straightforward word, just the right word.
Yeah, completely right. Yeah, I think
Will Self, take note.
Another great book is, if you've not, even though it's about screenwriting, but William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade. Again, he's brilliant. He writes about, this is the guy who wrote The Princess Bride and Butch and Sundance, God knows what else, but great writer, great novelist, great screenwriter. And he once said, there's no such thing as a good writer, but there's lots and lots of really good rewriters. So he said, never be afraid. The hardest part is getting that first draft down, putting one word after another until you've got 80,000 or 100,000 words. Then the fun starts. Then you go back to the beginning and you realise that your character you've been with now for 100,000 words, now you've got to know them really well. You go back to chapter one, you're like, he wouldn't have said it like that, because you now know the character and you can rewrite. And most people will do, apart from one person I met, Frederick Forsyth, who basically sits down, types it, and that's it. That's the last draft. Right. I think everyone rewrites. And J.K. Rowling, I was lucky enough to meet her a little while ago, and she said the second Harry Potter book, she did about 30 rewrites,
Really?
Yeah, it's all about the rewriting, not the writing.
Any questions from the floor? Because we've hogged it amply. Anything you want to lob out and yell, feel free.
How long does a book take to write them in general? If you get 30 rewrites, how long would that take?
Depends if you've got a doggy daycare.
It's very true. I think it can vary a lot in terms of how long to write a book. I certainly, for myself, the biggest one I suppose I did was the History of Christmas book, and that took about 18 months on and off. And but I was doing lots of other jobs in the meantime as well. In fact, I finished the last draft of it, and again that was a couple of rewrites. I had a sort of a paying writing job, and I was writing the script for the BBC Music Awards. And it was a live show. I was backstage sort of doing my work was done as soon as they said, you know, welcome to the BBC Music Award, my work was done because I was putting the stuff in the auto queue and doing the links for the presenters. So as they were introducing...
He writes for Tiny Temper.
I write all of his best ad-lib raps.
That's it, got you.
As, you know, the acts were on... And Robbie Williams was on stage doing some big song, and I was backstage just writing the last bit about Christmas, and, you know, and then, you know, this is the difference between Father Christmas and Santa Claus, how you can tell one's got a bobble hat, one's got a hood, and, you know. And right, you know, four feet away there was sort of...
But the fact that you can do that, you can write in the gaps between your day job. That's the skill. It's being able to sit down and think, I've got 10 minutes spare. What can I do in these 10 minutes? Because, I mean, my first book, I wrote, you know, when I was still doing an 40-hour week job and I had kids and grandkids and things like that, still managed to fit it in just by getting into that.
Well, that way you're on the police force. You went on surveillance. Go, oh,
shit. No, that would have been really useful. But, yeah, it's... it took me to write A Murder to Die For. It took me about 18 months because... Right. The idea, actually took about 8 years for the initial idea, but it took 18 months to sit down and do it word after word. But the second book, I didn't have all the distraction of anything else because I wasn't writing QI at that point, and that took about 3 months.
So I know a lot of writers who are just the full-on sort of novelists, particularly the self-publishers, who just, they have to churn them out because they know that they want to get that read-through thing, and if you go a year without a book, your fans may drift off, whatever. And I know a lot of those guys do set themselves a limit of like 2,000 words a day.
Yeah.
Wow.
And if they sort of missed that, they've got to catch up, you know. And,
wow.
And then, to get a 70,000 odd sort of novel, you're looking at 35 days of that. But then that's the first draft, then it's the next and the next. Mm-hmm. So you can do it in 3 months.
Depends what your subject matter is. I mean, I wrote 80,000 words, but I also had to drink quite a lot to resonate. So mine was it took me 3 years. But there again, every bit, you know, for example, when the chat's about gin, I thought, well, I can't just write about gin, I'll go to a gin masterclass. So you go and do things to sort of it's quite a nice
into a drinking game.
Kind of
a paragraph with your fingers.
But you know, I want to make sure that I
Did you try every drink then? If you're writing a chapter about sherry.
I wouldn't mention anything unless I tried it. There was a famous a wine sommelier called Matt Skinner, who's Jamie Oliver's best mate, and he reviewed a bunch of wines that hadn't actually come out yet and was ridiculed, and that was the end of his career. So you've got to be very careful. So, I went and I researched.
Know your stuff.
Mm. And also the camera, they've got. That's the other thing. With Unbound, you can do what you want to do. For example, with camera, I was told that I criticised quite heavily some big beer companies who run pubs who destroyed pub, and I was told you can't mention that because that will be libel. So I had to water things down.
Well, we get warned about, you know, anything that's sort of libelous.
Yeah,
but obviously, think twice about putting that in.
Exactly.
Could you make it someone else? You know, could you make it Bill Collins the drummer?
Dick Wakeman.
You do get warnings about, you know, if you're going to mention real people, be a little bit careful, and real organisations. I try and make up people.
I've got a dilemma at the minute. I'm trying to, one of the other many things I'm trying to write is a sort of, I don't know what you call it, it's like a fiction but true history, like Robert Harris does, you know. But a fiction
faction
version. Faction, is that what
faction,
we call it?
Yeah.
Faction. Robert Harris has mostly done this about ancient Rome and things like that. The thing I'm trying to write is for about 100 years ago, and so I've checked all the main characters in it have now died, but only just. And I'm kind of working out, I think, because you can't libel someone who's died.
You're not going to kill them.
No. I'm not going to kill them. That would be a good plot, to kill someone off so that you can then libel them. So I'm just trying to work out how careful you need to be when it's just, you know, kind of recent enough history. You can get away, you can say a lot about Caesar, you say what you like about Caesar, but can you say stuff about someone who maybe...
If you're past the libel section, you're then into sensitivity, really, because they will still have family.
Well, that's true.
That's true.
I mean, I'm being nice, right, you know, but I am putting words in their mouths, which therefore they didn't necessarily say. So it's just, but I think it's just being fair.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? The historical fiction and, you know, Hilary Mantel and... Where does that stand? What's the
point? I don't know. Just read a history book, you know.
No, but what's the historical fiction? You know, is a blurred line, isn't it?
It is, and I think, you know, because you've got to base it on what is known, what is out there. But then also, there's often those obvious behind closed doors moments where you think no one would quite know what Henry VIII said to Anne Boleyn at this point. we'll go with this for now.
So I hope you're enjoying Comedians with Books, which is a live show we did here in 2019. But 2020 holds different things. I think it's a year of novel writing and writing a TV drama idea, more radio stuff, more gigs. Hey, why not book me? Why don't you do just that? You can get in touch with me, Paul at paulcarenza.com. To do just that, as indeed these people have. Comedians and Carols is my touring show I do this time of year, our 12th or 13th year now, I think it is. This year takes us to Coventry and Frinton. We've got a Leicester show on election night, 12th of December. Do come to that, Aylston's Black Horse in Leicester, with Andy Kind and Tony Coward. It's going to be a great fun show, December 12th. We've got Woking, we've got Bewdley in Worcestershire, Raynes Park, Derby Cathedral, Sidcup, Colchester, Chatham, all on comediansandcarols.com. You can head to that website, find out more info on what I'm up to on the mailing list, because who knows when the next one of these podcasts will come along. You can't guarantee finding all the latest info on this one. Not that that's necessarily why you listen, but thanks if you do anyway. Thanks for putting up with me basically waffling on about what I'm up to, but you know, I've got to tell somebody. So something else will land here at some point in podcast form. Don't know when. Don't quite know what. I've got an idea for a podcast I mentioned earlier, but on previous episodes, but it's rather ambitious, so we'll see on that. For now, though, I'm over on the Audible original podcast, Christmas What the Fa-la-la-la-la, hosted by me and Grace Dent. Do join us. Last words now from James Dowdswell and Stephen Colgan.
So obviously you've written a few novels. What about script writing? You know, both of you, you've written a lot of jokes. Well, how does that... Is it a different part of the brain, or how does...
Yeah, I suppose, maybe, I said to a degree, but for me, I mean, the one I was just talking about there, in fact, you know, the sort of 100 years old kind of stuff, I'm trying to also write at the same time as a script, and I'm, in theory, thinking, I've got this one idea, it could work as a novel, could be a TV show, let's try both, but I'm finding that incredibly difficult, because as a TV thing, your scenes have to be a lot shorter, and you kind of bang them out. There's also a certain structure to screenwriting. They say there are plotters and pantsers, those who plot their books and then do it by the seat of their pants. Whereas with screenwriting fiction, you know, dramas and comedies, there are those kind of set rules. You kind of need to hit your key scenes and things. So it's a lot more knowing the theory.
It's a tricky thing as well, in the fact that a lot of the joy of writing a book is playing with language. You know, I mean, the reason that, you know, the great P.G. Woodhouse or even Douglas Adams don't translate terribly well to film and TV because all the joy of reading their books is in the language. You know, when P.G. Woodhouse writes something like Aunt Agatha's smile evaporated like the breath of a morning razor, that's a wonderful image. And if you were filming that and it's Maggie Smith playing Aunt Agatha, all she'd do is... it's just not the same. And when, you know, it's the same with Douglas Adams. He wrote these extraordinarily wonderfully descriptive passages, which when you suddenly do that in CGI, all the charm and the nuance is lost. And so, I mean, if I'm trying to write something as a script, I tend to write something that's very, very different. I mean, people always moan when they say, oh, I went to see the film and it was nothing like the book. Chances are, for very good reasons, because the book, as it stood, wouldn't translate properly to film. You have to think of film in a completely different medium. When I say film, I'm talking about TV as well, obviously. It's a completely different medium, and it's a visual medium, whereas books is all about the mind. I mean, as I say, you know, books have all the best pictures, don't they? They're the same as radio does, because it's all about your head. So,
You can luxuriate in a book a little bit more.
You can,
pontificate.
As you said, you dive into someone's head a lot more. On TV, it's show, don't tell, and all that stuff, I suppose.
Even things like what the character looks like. I mean, if you read a novel by George MacDonald Fraser or someone like that, or even, you know, something like the Adrian Mole books, you form a very fixed idea in your head from the brief description. So most authors don't describe their characters very closely. They let the author, they let the, basically the reader do the work. But then when they turn it to a TV show, they think, well, that's not what I thought he looked like. And that can utterly change your view of the character. And
there's also, I've heard as well of some novelists who've adapted their work to telly, you know, as a drama or something, and then they found the stage directions, they sort of, the first draft, they write in a rather flouncy fashion for stage directions, where actually we don't need to know about the house looked like surrender in building form. No, it just was, tell us what we need to know for the people to maybe make the show, because obviously that will never be heard, that stage direction, but you just need to, the set designer needs to know what colour you're in.
My favourite film is Widnall and I, and I've got the screenplay, which I got signed, and the this, if anybody ever likes Wooden or Lie, get the screenplay because the stage directions you put.
Bruce just writes brilliantly. Yeah, it's fantastic.
In fact, that's the best book event I've been to. Cheltenham Festival of Literature, about 1998. My best friend couldn't go, so I said to my mum, oh, should we go and see Richard E. Grant do Widnall's Diary? We get there, Cheltenham Festival of Literature, the main town hall. Turns out Richard E. Grant can't make it. But standing in the place is Bruce Robinson, the director and writer. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. My mum's like, there's Richard E. Grant. I said, mum, you're going to enjoy this. We sat in row three, and then it was quite apparent, quite clear, that Bruce Robinson was Widnall. He had sciatica. He couldn't stand still. He was moving around. He grabbed the bottle of wine, was stalking the stage. He'd go, do you know, I put every word of that movie in that bastard Grant's mouth. What's he doing tonight? Spice Girls the movie. What's utter balls? And then afterwards, I got it signed. And he said, what do you want me to say? And I said, it's been a most memorable evening, and you just scrawled something and then just fell flat. And he gets the publicity agent, I'm so sorry, I was the last person to get signed. He's a little bit drunk. I said, no, that's exactly what I wanted.
I can imagine. And he's lying on the floor screaming, bring me booze!
I can see an alcohol theme throughout your work. And your inspiration start there. Any other business before we finish? Anyone wanted to ask me? Yes, sir. Yes,
is it like when you get to the end of the last read through and it's finally ready to go? What's it like to leave it and just let it go out there?
Oh, for me, I'm a mixture of relief and terrifying, yeah. Because you sort of think, oh, this thing I've worked on for so long is out there. But also that thing of, I can't change it now. And every I've done about 6-7 books now. Every one I've done, as that's gone, I've gone, I needed one more look, didn't it?
Oh, it did.
And there's a couple of minor errors. There's a couple of, in the History of Christmas book, I've only had one person pick out a factual correction, which I think was Elvis Costello was the manager of the Pogues rather than the producer. I'm looking at Stephen like he knows this. Which I said he was the producer, I think he was the manager. And this ties into the fact that he bet, again it goes back to alcohol, he had a drunken bet with Shane McGowan of the Pogues that they couldn't write a Christmas song.
Wow.
Because the Pogues, of course, were not really known for their, you know, religious folk. You know, they had a bit of folk stuff, but they didn't. That was like they were the last person people you'd ever expect a Christmas song.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, Shane McGowan, you know, he had a few drinks in there, and was like, "Yeah, I could do a Christmas song." And I think it's fairly famous the results of that. Anyway. So, but there you go. But I got the title wrong. It's manager, not producer. So you always regret one little.
It is difficult. I mean, I think it was Leonardo da Vinci who said, art is never finished, it's only ever abandoned. It's kind of true. You kind of have to finish and move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Like great art, we should abandon.
By the way, just as a thing, in terms of your name, you mentioned your name, Stephen. My next door neighbour is called, he's an Australian bloke called Tristan, and he's married a woman called Akko Kobayashi, and he refuses to take her name. I was going, if you don't take her name, I'm going to take her name. Tristan Kobayashi, that is an author's name.
I met a bloke a couple of years ago who had the best name ever. His name was Jeff Leppard.
That's his own tribute band.
Yeah, I know. If he does a form of tribute band called Jeff Leppard, I'll be so cross.
Can you only have one arm? That's what I'm going to
do. Just a great name.
Okay. Double down.
On that bombshell, let us leave this merry occasion. But thanks. So, Stevens, your books are A Murder to Die For
and The Diabolical Club.
Diabolical Club. They're both here this evening. James, yeah. Your book is The Pub Manifesto, and it's also available here this evening and online at all the usual retailers.
And Paul's books are here, of course.
My books are here as well. And round of applause for our comedians you've seen. Comedians with books, Stephen Crowder.
So that's it. We're done here. Our new podcast will return here at some juncture. For now, though, enjoy the back episodes. If you want a Christmassy one, The Nonagon Club, that was episode 25 last year. Loads of Christmas historical stuff in there. Not as much, though, as on the new Audible original podcast, Christmas What the Falala. Find us over there. paulcorinza.com/audible.php. It's in the show notes. Even if you've had that free trial, you can grab another. I will shut up about that now. I promise you. Have a good one. Merry listening to wherever and whatever you listen to next. Be excellent to each other. God bless you. Season's greetings. Whatever season you're in. I don't know. Could be summer. And catch you next time. Somewhere, somewhen. I wish you well.